This podcast is brought to you in part by Contact My Politician, a free, fast way to find your local and national politicians and to keep them accountable. Click on their banner at our website, michaelmedved.com.
Your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when it's appropriate. 1 week before the election, 1 week and 1 day, actually. The election is a week from tomorrow. Can you believe it? It's appropriate to ask that old Rodney King question. Can't we all get along? There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal, America's best newspaper and a great source of conservative opinion, that basically talks about neighbors trying to come to terms with one another when they're split on politics. Is it possible to enjoy friendships and relationships and even intimate connection with people who disagree with you on the divide between Trump and Biden? It would seem like the answer ought to be an easy yes, but all of this is complicated by the coronavirus and responses to it. There's a new publication in the publication, and it is an academic publication. It is widely accepted and respected, called Nature Medicine, and it's a posting by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington Medical School. This is the same modeling group that basically warned about what the coronavirus pandemic might mean for the United States. And when President Trump says that his efforts have helped to save 2 million lives, their initial estimation of the pandemic was that if we did absolutely nothing, if there was no change in behavior, there were no lockdowns, there were no masks, there was no social distancing, there's no hand washing, none of that, we would have come out of the pandemic with about 2.2 million deaths, which is horrible, of course, almost unthinkable. We have not done nothing. We have greatly uprooted our normal life. And part of this hostility that you see all around us, I couldn't believe it. This morning I was reading about over the weekend, there was a confrontation with things thrown at different parties and people slugging each other and police being called because there were different sign carriers in Woodinville, Washington, which is a very nice suburb of Seattle. It's partially there are wineries up there in Woodinville and breweries, yes, but it was not at the time of day where people would necessarily have been impacted by that. And there were different kinds of liquid that were thrown into people's faces, and they're trying to analyze what it was because it caused stinging and pain in the eyes. And who knows? This is in Woodinville, for goodness sake. And it's a craziness that we're going through. But the background for it, it seems to me, is very important. I mentioned the Institute for Medical Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME. And this report, which is extremely detailed, talks about what's going to be unfolding between now and the end of February. And they agree with all of the scientists, and literally there is no disagreement about this, except from President Trump himself. We will not have vaccines available for mass distribution by the army, as President Trump suggests, or anything else. That won't happen until the end of February. And that's optimistic. And that's February of next year. That's when President Trump has begun his second term, or there is a new president. And using our model, says the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, and projections of critical driving covariates, pneumonia seasonality, mobility, testing rates, and mask use per capita. We assess scenarios of social distancing mandates and levels of mask use. Projections of current non-pharmaceutical intervention strategies by state with social distancing mandates reinstated whenever a threshold of 8 deaths per million population is exceeded. There are a bunch of states where it's been exceeded recently, which are in the process of trying to put things back and put in more social distancing mandates enforced by government. In any event, with all of that, and with mask use, at least at its current levels, they suggest that by the 28th of February, 2021, we will have a total death toll of 511,373 people. More than twice where we are now. It could be as bad, they say, as 578,000 lives. The horrible thing here is that if we give up all sanctions and there is no common mask wearing and people just forget about all of it, we'll have over a million deaths. This is not a joke. It's not going away. And I think more and more people are concerned about it. Concerning masks, we find that achieving universal mask use, which means that 95% of people mask when they go out in public, that kind of mask use could be sufficient to ameliorate the worst effects of epidemic resurgences in many states. Universal mask use, that means not absolutely everybody, but 95% of people using masks, could save an additional 129,000 lives between now and the end of February. It's a lot of lives to save by just a little thing like masks. President Trump was full of optimism, as he has been, full of optimism this morning in Allentown, Pennsylvania, when he was speaking with reporters. This is clip one, Jeremy, about the state of the virus. Listen.
We've done an incredible job. Take a look at what's happening in Europe. What's happening to Europe is nobody's seen anything like it. And you used to tell me all about Europe. Now we're doing a great job. We are absolutely rounding the corner. Other than the fake news wants to scare everybody, we are absolutely rounding the corner.
Okay. Does the fake news just really want to scare everybody, or is it a matter for some concern? It's precisely some of the states that are solidly for President Trump that are states like North Dakota. There are swing states like Wisconsin where they have this huge upsurge in cases. Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, went on, I believe it's Face the Nation this weekend. This is clip two, and he said, get to Mark Meadows in just a moment. Basically, he's talking about the virus strategy for President Trump going forward, because this is one of those things that people need to get a grip on. Even if President Trump does not win re-election, and President Trump and a lot of observers looking at the enthusiasm at his rallies, looking at the very strong support he is registering in some states that he does need to carry, are saying, no, he can be reelected. But even if he's not reelected, he continues as our president until January 21st of next year. What happens with the virus between now and then? We will get to that. Also, Washington State just received an award. On what? A vote-by-mail system. What score did we receive? That's coming up next. On the Michael Medved Show, talking about the ongoing efforts to try to deal with the coronavirus, which is obviously a very major issue in this election, and should be. And also, in the midst of the coronavirus disagreement and everything else that is going on, how do you maintain relationships with people who may disagree with you? And wherever you are, you'll find such people there, out there. Mark Meadows, the former congressman from North Carolina, the president's chief of staff, according to some reports, the president's very unhappy with Mark Meadows. Who knows? Mark Meadows was on Face the Nation, and he said this about the coronavirus.
The only person waving a white flag along with his white mask is Joe Biden. I mean, when we look at this, we're going to defeat the virus. We're not going to control it. We will try to contain it as best we can. And if you look at full context of what I was talking about is we need to make sure that we have therapeutics and vaccines. We may need to make sure that when people get sick, that they have the kind of therapies that the President of the United States has that we can provide. Those emergency use authorizations hopefully will be coming in very short order. We're hopeful, very hopeful, based on a number of conversations that vaccines are, you know, just a few weeks away, and we're in preparation for that.
Okay. The medical experts do not believe that the vaccines are just a few weeks away in terms of them actually being able to be used. And I know that this is the particular line, but again, remember the president was saying for weeks that they would have a vaccine before the election. Now, the election's 8 days from now. We're not going to have a vaccine. And the idea... And by the way, I spent some time, because I think it is profoundly important to deal with some of the realities that you just see in the numbers. Because if they are right at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at University of Washington, which everybody sort of looks at as the experts on what is happening with the coronavirus, then even with the idea of widespread masking and more enforced social distancing strategies from the various states, the death rate between now and the end of February is going to go up. It's not going down. And what President Trump has said before is correct. If you look at Europe, they, including countries that thought they had the virus under control, it was coming up again. And by the way, this is exactly what the experts had predicted, because that whole idea of a second wave, when the weather changes and people have to spend more time indoors in cold climates in particular, it's a threatening and serious matter. And speaking of a serious matter, one of the items of controversy surrounding the president and his campaign has to do with this 60 Minutes interview that was broadcast last night. And probably less depressing than the Seahawks game, which was available last night, unfortunately. The Seahawks lost their first game of the year, and I hope their last game that they will lose this year. But on CBS, on 60 Minutes, President Trump did speak a bit about the virus and also about his problems with Dr. Fauci. And before the interview even began, President Trump asked and wanted to make sure that Leslie Stahl would treat him fairly. This is clip 25, 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl on the President of the United States.
Are you ready for some tough questions? You're going to be fair.
I'm going to be fair.
Just be fair.
But last time, I remember you saying to me, you know, bring it on.
No, I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for fairness. That's all.
You're going to get fairness. But you're okay with some tough questions.
No, I'm not.
You're not okay with tough questions.
Well, I'm going to be fair. You don't ask Biden tough questions.
Me? I don't need
it's
to.
Terrible. It's terrible.
I don't need
terrible.
It from you.
You know that. Okay. Are you ready?
Everybody ready?
We're out.
Okay, that was right before they went on, and they broadcast it. And Biden, by the way, got some tough questions, some of which he handled very poorly when he was being interviewed by Nora O'Donnell on the same broadcast of 60 Minutes. But here is Leslie Stahl asking President Trump about his relationship with Dr. Fauci. This is clip four.
You called Dr. Fauci and other health officials idiots.
Where did I call him an idiot?
You called them idiots. I wonder if you think...
Well, he's been wrong a lot. I like him, but he's been wrong a lot.
I wonder if you think that masks don't work.
I feel masks possibly work. But certainly you want to stay away a certain distance, socially distance, etc. But I would say a mask works, and I have nothing against masks, and I tell people to wear masks. I have
well,
no
tell
problem.
Me then about these rallies you've been having.
A lot of people are wearing
people,
masks.
A lot of outside. People aren't. I'm watching all these people jammed in together, and I'm seeing most of them without masks. And I'm wondering the message that you're sending with these pictures coming across television.
Take a look. Yesterday, we were in Arizona, record-setting rallies, numbers of people like nobody's seen before.
You used to have bigger rallies.
No, these are much bigger than I ever
had. I don't want to bicker over that.
You know,
tell me about
you're
the
so
mask
negative.
Wearing.
You're so negative. These are the biggest rallies we've ever had. You just come in here with that negative attitude. These are the biggest rallies we've ever had.
But I can't believe after what happened in the Rose Garden here, after the announcement, with all the people getting sick, that you are not being more strongly encouraging about wearing masks at your rallies.
I tell people to wear
but
masks.
But you don't.
Leslie, we hand out thousands of masks.
But you look out and they're not wearing them. You don't get up there and say, look, you know, come on. I don't want you to get sick.
What's your next question, Leslie? We're outside. The rallies are bigger than they've ever been. There's more enthusiasm than we've ever had.
There's certainly a lot of enthusiasm. There's no question about it. And they are very big rallies, whatever Leslie Stahl wants to say. This has come up particularly painfully today because Mark Short, who is a good guy and who is the chief of staff for Vice President Pence, is sick. He has the coronavirus, and so do at least four other people on the vice president's staff and the people who were closest to him, including his body man, the guy who was his closest personal aide. So under CDC rules, Mike Pence is supposed to be quarantining just as a protective measure because he's been exposed to these folks. He's out campaigning, though he won't be there tonight for the vote on Amy Barrett. Is all of this, is everything our lives, is that all based on chance? Sean Carroll, who's vice president for science education at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, says, yup. We'll get to that coming up on the MedVed Show. Michael Medved Show. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Sean Carroll, who is the Vice President for Science Education at Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He's also the Chair of Biology at University of Maryland and is the author of an unreasonably amusing and informative and challenging new book called A Series of Fortunate Events. The subtitle is Chance and the Making of the Planet, Life, and You. And it's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Mr. Carroll, let me ask you at the very outset, what does chance have to do with the coronavirus?
Oh, a lot. Well, thanks, Michael, for having me on. Well, there's millions and millions of viruses out there in wildlife, And occasionally, if we make close contact, it might be by butchering and eating wildlife, might be from a bite, might be from droppings in a cave, those viruses can infect us. And those spillover events are what gave us Ebola and Zika and AIDS and MERS and SARS. So it's that these are randomly mutating viruses living inside, well, replicating inside of their animal hosts. And it's a combination of chance mutation that allows them to infect humans and an encounter with humans. And away we go. We start with an infection that probably most of the time doesn't go anywhere, but in this case, it took off like wildfire, and we're all paying the price.
Do you think, do you agree with some of those folks who think that the lockdown strategy, everything that we've done to try to control the virus, has been some kind of overreaction?
No, I don't. I mean, I think lockdowns have been really different in different countries, even in different states, so it's kind of hard to just generalize. I think the idea here's the general idea. The general idea is the course of infection is going to run a couple of weeks, and generally healthy people, their immune systems will subdue the virus, and hopefully they won't need hospitalization or worse. So you're trying to break the chain of transmission. That's what the lockdown is really about. But, you know, we didn't do it in a synchronized way, so that while some places were locked down, other places were open, and some places start reopening, et cetera. So it was kind of leaky the way we did it, you know. In some places, I think Taiwan, South Korea, China, the lockdowns were pretty absolute, and it really broke the chain of transmission. So the resurgence was, slight or none in those places. So it's a good strategy, but it's all in the execution.
What about the whole idea of people who are trying to find some higher purpose? And I know what you're going to think about this, because you generally are not looking for higher purposes. You're looking for the rule of chance in life and even in the creation of life. Do you acknowledge that it's extremely unlikely that life even came into existence? Why is it you're certain that it would be chance and not the some kind of heavenly plan?
Well, let's unpack that a little bit. It's a great question, and you know, I'm not ignorant of all sorts of worldviews on this point. So
no, of course you address.
And the book really emphasizes things pretty close to us, and things that are pretty, and that's deliberate on my part. Tangible things like, you know, how many different children could one human couple make? Well, it turns out 70 trillion. You know, my mom stopped at 4. So you know, there's an element of chance in our biological lives, the chromosomes we happen to inherit, the mutations that are either good, bad, or otherwise that we get. When you go sort of further away, science has less to say. So we know about continents moving around, and that changes the face of the Earth. We know about things like the asteroid impact that happened 66 million years ago. So I think there's a lot of theologies out there. Some put God closer to humans and intervening, and some put God further away and sort of putting things in motion. And of course, some people don't put God in the picture at all. So I'm not weighing in too heavily on any of those scenarios, just to say that we account for lots of phenomena by chance. But science is largely silent on, a creator, at least in the sense of sort of putting everything into motion. It's just it's kind of outside our domain. So that's why I think, tens and tens of millions of Americans both embrace, a scientific and a faith-based view. And they coexist in lots of people. And, I think it's important to acknowledge that.
And you do. The book is called A Series of Fortunate Events. You have an event toward the end of your book, which I think people find very memorable. It's a meeting of the minds that includes Sarah Silverman, Bill Maher, Albert Camus, and Jacques Monod, another great philosopher you're very enamored of in your book. How is it you were able to bring these people back from the dead to engage in this exchange?
Well, thanks for asking. Well, I was trying to think of a way to
maybe do it a little more, to have the conversation with people, interesting thinkers that have said or thought interesting things. And I one day, I think I just imagined, wouldn't it be great to have them all in the room at the same time? And I thought, well, as a literary device, I could try to do that. So I basically used almost essentially all verbatim quotes from these folks, or from quotes they gave me by interviewing them. Eric Idle was kindly enough, for example, to give me an interview. And I know some of these other folks like Seth MacFarlane. And to have a conversation about just what you were asking me, about the search for meaning. And, you know, and I tried to, you know, represent these people well. And I also, I think that, you know, there's more hope and more compassion and more empathy in the world than sometimes people may expect, you know, coming from a scientific worldview. But I thought some of these folks said some of those things fairly well. And, yeah, I thought it was meant to be it was a literary device to essentially allow me to have a conversation with folks that I thought readers would find interesting.
Well, it works very well, and it's enormously entertaining, as is the rest of the book. Let me ask you, in your other life as a professor of biology, University of Maryland, do you think the virus goes away at any point before, say, next February or March or April?
No, I we're going to need a vaccine. So I feel really comfortable in saying that. I think that unless we took, again, very strong measures to lock ourselves down. Again, Michael, the idea, you know, basically we're locked inside for 4 or 6 weeks and there was no way for the virus to be passed from person to person. Essentially, the virus would burn out. There would be no chain of transmission. But I don't see that happening. But the great thing about the way a vaccine should work is to make us immune. And that is essentially means we're no longer a host for it. And the infection will the infections will decrease and hopefully disappear from the country, at least if vaccination is wide enough. So that's why all the emphasis on the vaccine. I should also reveal that I was trained in immunology, so I'm paying very close attention to the vaccine story, and I'm happy to say that I'm an optimist that we'll have a vaccine that will be effective against this virus. Lots of other data that's there, either from animals or from other information we have, makes me optimistic that this is a vaccine-preventable disease, just as measles is, or the flu is, or tetanus, or you know, a whole litany of things, or smallpox, things that we've vaccinated about, you know, over the decades. I remain optimistic that we'll have that.
Yeah, and we actually, and I think you mentioned it in your book, the book is called A Series of Fortunate Events, Chance in the Making of the Planet, Life, and You. It is enormously entertaining and informative, with all kinds of references to history and science and popular culture and Las Vegas odds and much more. Sean B. Carroll, thank you for joining us, and I hope you will join us again, and I hope you're 100% right about a vaccine coming at some point next year to get us out of this dire situation. We'll be right back. Okay, let's acknowledge it. The stock market spooked by the rising level of coronavirus and the economic impact and no stimulus hope. Market tanked today. It was bad and ugly. But for too long, the best investment opportunities have only been offered behind closed doors. Angels and VCs, venture capitalists, get in early on the most promising companies, while maybe you're waiting for them to reach the multi-billion dollar valuations before you even get a chance to invest. Well, that ends right now. At Our Crowd, they're opening the doors to today's top pre-vetted opportunities. Startups, a lot of them. So you can invest early alongside angels and VCs. Find out about how this works and how it can be of tremendous benefit to you, particularly at a time of market turbulence. Check it out. Go to michaelmedved.com. Click on the banner for Our Crowd. This is a key way to participate in the revolutionary world of high-tech startups, particularly with emphasis on those in the nation of Israel. Check it out. Go to michaelmedved.com. Click on the banner for Our Crowd. There was a piece, speaking of Our Crowd, about how people are able to come together every once in a while, even across very bitter political lines. This is in the Wall Street Journal. It's a piece by Claire Ansberry. And the headline, and it's a big spread, big analysis, how neighbors split on politics can stay close. Troubled by the national discourse, the Gateses and the Mitchells use yard signs to send a message of civility. Here is a story. It says the Mitchells, lifelong Democrats, planted a Joe Biden sign in the front yard of their suburban Pittsburgh home. The Gateses, who live right next door, are lifelong Republicans, and they proudly put a Donald Trump sign in theirs. It's actually a Trump-Pence sign. Another homemade sign stands in each yard. It reads, "We love them," that's heart them, with an arrow pointing in the direction of the... Their next-door neighbors put up a Trump-Pence sign. And part of what happened with this story is that somebody stole or took away or ripped up, destroyed the Biden-Harris sign. And then they took down the Trump sign as well because the lady of the house was tired of people giving dirty looks. They live in a suburban Pittsburgh in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania. And so what they decided to do, because they had become good friends, they don't even try to change each other's political point of view. They were having their mixed Monday where they get together. They're in the same COVID-19 bubble. So they get together. They each have three kids of approximately the same age. The kids are friends. And they said, you know what? Let's do something nice. So they put up signs on each side. And the signs have a great big heart in it. And it says, "One Nation." And then, "We love them," pointing to the sign next door, which says Trump-Pence. And then the Trump-Pence people have a sign that says, "We love them," pointing to the Biden-Harris sign. And this has inspired a lot of attention locally in the Pittsburgh area, in the swingiest of key swing states in Pennsylvania, and has led to a reflection and to this big article in Wall Street Journal. "They don't argue," writes Claire Ansberry. "They don't label each other. They listen to each other's perspective. They look for common ground and recognize that reasonable and good people can reach different conclusions. I think it boils down to respect," says Chris. That's Chris Mitchell, who's that's the family that's the pro-Biden family. "We have no desire or illusion that we're going to change them or each other's minds. The families also look for common ground. Stuart, a banker, and Bart, an accountant, often talk about the economy's ills. Both agree that the country's debt levels are too high," amen to that, "and that more revenue is needed, but disagree on how much individuals and corporations should be taxed and where spending cuts should be made. The heart sign was prompted by a conversation over a weekly dinner together, a relatively new tradition they've started called Monday Mixer." And "I'm going to make a sign," Chris recalls saying, "one that showed that they loved their Trump-supporting neighbors. Jill said she wanted to make one too, declaring affection for their Biden-supporting neighbors. Our fundamental job as parents is to be a good role model for our children," says Bart. "We don't see them as Democrats. They're the Mitchells. We know they are good people who live next door." Don't you think America could use more of that. Right below this particular piece in the Wall Street Journal, there's another piece, which is an interview with a psychologist named Gene Safer, who has a private psychotherapy practice in Manhattan for more than 45 years. Now, she's involved in a, quote, mixed marriage. She is a liberal Democrat. Her husband is a conservative. They've been married for a very long time. And she specializes in helping couples overcome political boundaries. And one of the questions she's asked in this interview is, why does it bother us so much when someone we love disagrees politically? And she says, we have a fantasy that people who are our intimates are going to be like us in every fundamental way. We wonder, how can somebody important to me not see what I see? And yet there are always going to be significant points of contention in an intimate relationship. And then she asked a big question. Should we avoid discussing politics? She said, yes, if you feel it will lead to an argument. You can have a discussion if you can both do it civilly without raising your voices. But the key to having a decent political conversation with someone who has opposing beliefs is to listen more than you talk. Because you can only be responsible for how you conduct yourself. You can always say, we just don't see this. We just see this very differently. It seems to me that that was the encouraging part about the exchange last Thursday night. Believe it or not, it was only last Thursday night when they had the second debate. At least it was a little bit more respectful. Did it seem like Biden and Trump actually liked each other? Absolutely not. I think that's expecting more than is likely to develop. But to be able to talk to people and maybe to recognize, as these Gateses and Mitchells did in Pittsburgh, that there are good people on all sides and in every side of the issues before our country right now, I think that's going to help us. Not so much on November 3rd. I mean, we're kind of baked in our ideology for November 3rd. But on November 4th, the day after the election, when I hope we have a winner the day after the election and it's clear and we don't have a long, extended post-election struggle, that would be bad for the country, especially with the continuing threat of the pandemic. But if we are going to go forward, we ought to find ways to go forward together. And even in the last months of a president's term, if that's what the people decide in the election, or the beginning, really, of a second term, if that's what we decide in the election, doing something that is big and constructive, like maybe cleaning up election messes, that, it seems to me, is a worthwhile endeavor for this greatest nation on God's green earth.